Psychiatrists and psychopharmacologists on the front lines, who consistently say that they have seen these drugs work time after time, cannot all have been fatally duped by the drug industry's marketing campaigns. Sometimes, the statistical reality of the randomized, double-blind, controlled studies says one thing, while the clinical reality, what psychiatrists and primary care physicians observe in and hear from their patients, says another. What to make of all this? I am willing to believe that, for the most part anyway, both sides in these debates are arguing in good faith. The pro-medication advocates, the Gerald Clermans and Frank Bergers and Peter Kramers and Dr. Harvards of the world, have a compassionate Hippocratic desire to reduce their patients' anxious suffering with drugs, and they are sincere in their desire to destigmatize anxiety disorders and clinical depression by classifying them as medical problems. The anti-medication crusaders, the Peter Breggins and Dr. Stanfords of the world, are sincere in their desire to protect patients and would-be consumers against what they believe to be the profit-minded rapaciousness of the drug companies and to help patients recover from their anxiety on the strength of their own inner resources, rather than on potentially dependency-inducing medications. I have sympathy for the more reasonable drug industry critics. I can say, based not only on the thousands of studies I've pored over, but on my own lived experience, that in some ways, the critics are clearly right. Right about the debilitating side effects, right about dependency and withdrawal problems, right to express skepticism about whether these drugs work as well as they're advertised to, right to worry about what the long-term effects of such a heavily medicated society will be. But in some ways, too, I believe they are wrong. The drugs, many other studies suggest, can work. Yes, only some of the time, in some people, with sometimes rotten side effects and bad withdrawal symptoms and dependency problems. And yes, we don't know what long-term damage they're wreaking on our brains. And yes, the diagnostic categories have been artificially inflated or distorted by the drug companies and the insurance industry. But I can tell you with hard-won personal authority that there is legitimate underlying emotional distress here, which can be quite debilitating, and which these drugs can mitigate, sometimes only a little, sometimes profoundly. When I talk to Dr. W. about this, he reports that his own clinical experience comports with what I have been finding in my research. There is enormous variability in how different patients respond to different drugs. He once treated a patient whose parents were Holocaust survivors. This woman was deeply depressed. It was clear to Dr. W. that she had internalized their survivor's guilt, a common phenomenon. He worked with her for months to get her to recognize this in an effort to dispel her unhappiness. Nothing helped. Her devastating depression persisted week after week. Then she tried Prozac. After a few weeks on the drug, she came for her appointment one day and said, "I feel great." A few weeks later, she deemed herself cured and terminated treatment. Score one for the SSRIs. But around that same time, Dr. W. had another patient, a man suffering from obsessive-compulsive disorder and low-grade depression. That patient, too, started on Prozac, and within 48 hours was in the hospital with acute suicidal ideation. Score one against the SSRIs. Another colleague of Dr. W.'s, let's call him Dr. G., was an eminent psychoanalytically trained psychiatrist who, late in his career, fell into a severe clinical depression. Dr. G. checked himself into Chestnut Lodge, a psychoanalytically oriented psychiatric hospital in Rockville, Maryland. For years, Dr. G. had been a professional opponent of biological psychiatry, arguing that Freudian talk therapy was the best way to treat anxiety and depression. But daily sessions of analytic psychotherapy provided Dr. G. no relief from his suffering. Only when he consented to go on antidepressants did his condition improve. Dr. G.'s depression lifted, but he now found himself confronted with a professional crisis. Was psychoanalytic psychotherapy the foundation on which he'd built his career, a chimera? He died not long thereafter. Dr. W. has a psychopharmacologist colleague with whom he has collaborated for years. Together, they have successfully treated many patients with anxiety disorders. Whenever one of their patients gets better, Dr. W. will say to the psychopharmacologist, "It was clearly your drugs that did it." And he will respond to Dr. W., "No, it was clearly your psychotherapy that did it." And then they laugh and congratulate each other on another successful case. But the truth is, as Dr. W. acknowledges, they don't really know what made a given patient recover. It is much cheaper to tranquilize distraught housewives living in isolation and tower blocks with nowhere for their children to play than to demolish these blocks and to rebuild on a human scale, or even to provide playgroups. The drug industry, the government, the pharmacist, the taxpayer, and the doctor all have vested interests in medicalizing socially determined stress responses. Malcolm Lader, Benzodiazepines, Opium of the Masses, 1978. Just because I can explain your depression using terms such as serotonin reuptake inhibition doesn't mean you don't have a problem with your mother. Carl Elliott, The Last Physician, Walker Percy and the Moral Life of Medicine, 1999. Before Donald Klein's imipramine experiments, interpreting the content of one's anxiety mattered a lot. What does your phobia of heights or rats or trains mean? What is it trying to communicate to you? Imipramine drained anxiety of much of its philosophical meaning. Developments in pharmacology were showing anxiety to be merely a biological symptom, a physiological phenomenon, a mechanical process whose content didn't matter. Yet for philosophers like Kierkegaard and Sartre, anxiety resolutely does have meaning. For them, as well as for psychotherapists who resist reducing brain states to biology, anxiety is not something to be avoided or medicated, but rather the truest route to self-discovery. The road to, in the 60s inflected version of this idea, self-actualization. Dr. W. believes this. "Go into the heart of danger," he likes to say, quoting a Chinese proverb, "for there you will find safety." For evolutionary biologists, anxiety is a mental and physiological state that evolved to keep us safe and alive. Anxiety enhances our vigilance, prepares us to fight or flee. Being anxious can helpfully attune us to physical threats from the world. Freud believed anxiety attunes us not just to threats from the world, but to threats from within ourselves. Anxiety, in this view, is a sign that our psyche is trying to tell us something. Medicating away that anxiety, instead of listening to what it's trying to tell us, listening to Prozac, as it were, instead of listening to our anxiety, might not be what's called for if we want to become our best selves. Anxiety can be a signal that something needs to change, that we need to change our lives. Medication risks blocking that signal. Edward Drummond, a psychiatrist in New England, used to regularly prescribe benzodiazepine tranquilizers to his patients in order to reduce their anxiety. Today, he strongly believes tranquilizers are a significant cause of chronic anxiety. Taking Xanax or Ativan can temporarily alleviate acute anxiety, Drummond says, but at the cost of allowing us to avoid dealing with whatever issues are causing that anxiety. In Listening to Prozac, Peter Kramer engages the work of the novelist Walker Percy, whose writing grapples with how to cope with emotional pain and spiritual longing in the age of biological psychiatry. What gets lost, Percy's stories and essays ask, when anxiety and anomie are medicated away? Percy was well situated to tackle these issues. The hereditary taint, as Freud called it, of melancholy ran thick through the bloodlines of his southern family. His grandfather, his father, and possibly his mother, who drove herself off a bridge, committed suicide. Two of his uncles had nervous breakdowns. Percy's father, Leroy, a lawyer, medicated his depression with alcohol and sought treatment from specialists, traveling to Baltimore to meet with the leading psychiatrists at Johns Hopkins in 1925. But modern psychopharmacology was not yet available, and in 1929, Leroy succeeded in his second attempt at killing himself, shooting himself in the head with a 20-gauge shotgun. Walker's response was to study science. Believing that science would eventually explain everything in the cosmos, including the nature of the melancholy that killed so many members of his family, he decided to become a doctor. His medical training hardened his scientific materialism. If man can be reduced to the sum of his chemical and biological properties, as one of his biographers characterized Percy's reasoning as a young man, why worry about ideals, or lack thereof? But in 1942, Percy contracted tuberculosis and had to drop out of medical school, repairing to a sanatorium in Saranac Lake, New York, to recover. Streptomycin and, note this, isoniazid and iproniazid were still a few years away from being available as tuberculosis remedies, so the prescribed treatment was rest. While at the sanatorium, he fell into a depression and read intensively. Lots of Dostoevsky and Thomas Mann, as well as Kierkegaard and Thomas Aquinas. Feeling physically and emotionally unwell, he underwent a spiritual crisis in which he determined that science could not, after all, solve the problem of human unhappiness. Eventually, influenced especially by the writings of Kierkegaard, he decided to make a leap of faith and become a Catholic. Percy's conversion prompted his best friend, the novelist and Civil War historian Shelby Foote, to tell him, "Yours is a mind in full intellectual retreat." How differently might Percy's life and philosophy have turned out if he had been treated with iproniazid instead of with a curriculum of European novels and existential philosophy? Iproniazid, we now know, would shortly become the MAOI antidepressant Marsalid, a drug that might quickly have both cured his tuberculosis and dispelled his melancholy. He might well have returned to his medical training and never become a novelist. His opinion of biological psychiatry might have become considerably warmer. Peter Kramer makes observations along these lines in Listening to Prozac. Percy never lost his respect for the scientific method, but he came to distrust the reductionist worldview that claimed science as the philosophical basis of ethics and of all human knowledge. In fact, he came to believe that the high rates of depression and suicide in modern society were owed in part to the cultural triumph of the scientific worldview, which reduced man to a collection of cells and enzymes without supplying an alternative repository of meaning. In 1957, Percy wrote a two-part article for America, the weekly Jesuit magazine. "By focusing on the biological," he said, "psychiatry becomes unable to account for the predicament of modern man. Guilt, self-consciousness, sadness, shame, anxiety, these were important signals from the world and from our souls. Medicating these signals away as symptoms of organic disease risks alienating us further from ourselves. Anxiety is," Percy wrote, "under one frame of reference, a symptom to be gotten rid of. Under the other, it may be a summons to an authentic existence, to be heeded at any cost." Themes of anxiety, nervous disorders, and existential dread run through much of Percy's writing. In The Second Coming, Will Barrett, a retired lawyer, must cope with a strange affliction that descends on him after the death of his wife, a feeling of depression accompanied by a disturbance of his internal gyroscope, a hitch in his golf swing, and what his doctors believe may be petit mal seizures. Will suspects his neurotic ailment is caused by the world's being farcical, but one doctor suspects a small hemorrhage or arterial spasm near the brain's limbic system. Is Will's unhappiness a problem of meaning or a quirk of biology? As the novel progresses, Will's malaise deepens. His fainting spells become more frequent, and he becomes filled with religious yearning. Eventually, his family commits him to the hospital, where a doctor diagnoses him with Hausman syndrome, a disease invented by Percy, whose symptoms include, in addition to seizures, depression, fugues, certain delusions, sexual dysfunction alternating between impotence and satyriasis, hypertension, and what Dr. Hausman called wahnsinnige Sehnsucht, inappropriate longing. The disease is caused, Will's doctors explain, by a simple pH imbalance and is treated by the simplest of drugs, a hydrogen ion, a single nucleus of one proton. Will is consigned to a nursing home where his pH levels can be checked every few hours. "Remarkable, don't you think," says his doctor, "that a few protons, plus or minus, can cause such complicated moods? Lithium, the simplest metal, controls depression. Hydrogen, the simplest atom, controls wahnsinnige Sehnsucht." Will, ostensibly cured and living his circumscribed nursing home existence, marvels, "How odd to be rescued, salvaged, converted by the hydrogen ion. A proton as simple as a billiard ball. Did it all come down to chemistry after all? Had he pounded the sand with his fist in a rage of longing because his pH was 7.6? Percy, writing here in the late 1970s, when the catecholamine hypothesis of affective disorders and norepinephrine theory of depression were taking hold, is mocking the pretensions of biological reductionism. By reducing Will's humanity, not only his depression, but his ideas and his longings, to his hydrogen molecules, Percy is essaying a critique of modern psychopharmacology, which in his view pathologizes alienation. 7 years later, on the eve of Prozac's American launch, Percy published an even blunter critique of biological materialism. The Thanatos Syndrome featured a character named Thomas Moore, a psychiatrist who had appeared in an earlier novel, Love in the Ruins. In The Thanatos Syndrome, Dr. Moore, who has recently been released from jail, where he had been serving time for illegally selling the benzodiazepine Dalmane at truck stops, returns to his hometown of Feliciana, Louisiana, to find everyone acting strangely. The women of his town have developed a propensity for presenting themselves rearward for sex. His own wife, in addition to exhibiting this predilection, has developed a computer-like aptitude for playing bridge that has propelled her to success in national tournaments. He notes that anxious women have suddenly lost weight and self-consciousness while gaining boldness, sexual voracity, and emotional insensitivity. They shed old terrors, worries, rages like last year's snakeskin, and in its place is a mild, fond vacancy, a species of unfocused animal good spirits. It turns out that some supercilious civic leaders, including the director of the Quality of Life Division, a federal agency that oversees euthanasia programs, have taken it upon themselves to introduce a chemical called heavy sodium into the water supply, like fluoride, in an effort to improve the social welfare. Heavy sodium makes people more placid, less self-conscious, and more content. This is not necessarily a good thing. In losing their anxiety and self-consciousness, the citizens of Feliciana are becoming less human. Dosed with heavy sodium, Feliciana's women are no longer hurting. They are not worrying the same old bone, but there is something missing. Not merely the old terrors, but a sense in each of her. Her what? Herself? Dr. Moore is skeptical, but the heavy sodium advocates try to argue him around to their way of thinking. "Tom, we can see it," one zealous champion tells him. In a PET scanner! We can see the glucose metabolism of the limbic system, raising all kinds of hell and getting turned off like a switch by the cortex. We can see the locus coeruleus and the hypothalamus kicking in, libido increasing, healthy heterosexual libido and depression decreasing. We can see it. Mocking the arrogance of biological psychiatry, Percy means to warn that to medicate away guilt, anxiety, self-consciousness, and melancholy is to medicate away the soul. Many times in his writing, Percy alludes to Kierkegaard's idea that worse than despair is to be in despair and not realize it, to have anxiety but to have built your life around not experiencing it. We all know perfectly well that the man who lives out his life as a consumer, he writes in The Coming Crisis in Psychiatry, a sexual partner, an other-directed executive who avoids boredom and anxiety by consuming tons of newsprint, miles of film, years of TV time, that such a man has somehow betrayed his destiny as a human being. If anxiolytic medication mutes our anxiety, deafens us to it, allows us to be in despair without knowing it, does that somehow deaden our souls? Percy would seem to believe that it does. I believe all of this as far as it goes. I endorse the philosophical stances of Walker Percy and Søren Kierkegaard. And yet how much credibility do I have? After all, here I am, in my 30th year of taking psychiatric medications, with citalopram and alprazolam, and possibly still some of last night's clonazepam flowing through my bloodstream as I write this, my serotonergic and GABAergic systems boosted, my glutamate inhibited, agreeing with Peter Breggin that drugs are toxic, and with Walker Percy that they diminish the soul. Am I not a terribly compromised vessel for delivering this argument? And yet so, one might say, was Percy, who took sleeping medications for his chronic insomnia, and with good reason, his father's brutal insomnia played a large role in driving him to suicide. Psychiatric medications, for some people, in some situations, some of the time, work. To deny the schizophrenic chemical remission from his psychotic delusions, or the bipolar patient pharmacological relief from his self-endangering manias and crushing depressions, or, yes, the panic-ravaged and housebound individual some medical defense against anxiety, would be cruel. One can be, I believe, skeptical about the claims of the pharmaceutical industry, concerned about the sociological implications of a population that is so heavily medicated, and attuned to the existential trade-offs involved in taking psychiatric medications without being ideologically in opposition to the judicious use of these drugs. On the other hand, I know I would do well to heed Percy, as well as modern big pharma critics like Edward Drummond and Peter Breggin, because the irony of what I have had to ingest in order to write this section on drugs is obvious. I elevated my Celexa dosage, became dependent on Xanax and Klonopin, and consumed heroic quantities of alcohol to keep my anxiety at bay. After 40 years of never smoking a single cigarette, because after getting my grandmother to quit smoking in her 60s, I'd promised to never take up the habit myself, I smoked my first one at 41. After having been so afraid of recreational narcotics, perhaps an instance of the evolutionary adaptiveness of my innate caution, that I'd never for 40 years taken so much as a puff of marijuana, nor indulged in any other non-prescribed drug, I resorted in desperation, after reading Freud's enthusiastic papers about it, to trying cocaine and also amphetamines. Many nights, I would begin the evening fueled by caffeine and nicotine, which I needed to propel me out of torpor and hopelessness, only to overshoot into quaking, quivering anxiety. Thoughts racing, hands shaking, I would end the evening taking a Klonopin and then perhaps a Xanax and drinking a scotch, and then another, and another to settle down. This is not healthy. More constructively, I have tried to draw on Kierkegaard and Percy for backbone and solace, and I have also tried yoga and acupuncture and meditation. I would very much like to unlock my inner pharmacy, that repository of healthy, natural hormones and neurotransmitters that can be activated, the anti-drug New Age healers say, with meditation and biofeedback and better inner balance. But despite my best efforts, I'm fumbling with the keys. Part 4. Nurture versus Nature. Chapter 8. Separation Anxiety. The great source of terror in infancy is solitude. William James, The Principles of Psychology, 1890. When did my anxiety begin? Was it when I, as a toddler, would throw epic tantrums, screaming relentlessly and banging my head on the floor? The questions that confronted my parents were these. Was my behavior merely a slightly extreme but nonetheless typical manifestation of the terrible twos, or did it lie outside the band of the normal? What is the difference between childhood separation anxiety as a normal developmental stage and separation anxiety as a clinical or preclinical condition? Where is the line between temperamental inhibition as a normal personality trait and inhibition as a symptom of pathology, a sign of, say, incipient social anxiety disorder? On the matter of my tantrums, my mother's Dr. Benjamin Spock manual was not dispositive, so she took me to the pediatrician and described my behavior. Normal, was his conclusion, and his advice, in keeping with the laissez-faire approach to child-rearing of the early 1970s, was to let me cry it out. So my parents would watch in distress as I lay on the floor, screaming and writhing and smashing my head on the ground, sometimes for hours at a time. Then what to make of my extreme shyness at age 3? When my mother took me to my first day of nursery school, she couldn't, or wouldn't, separation anxiety cuts both ways with children and parents, leave because I clung to her leg and whimpered. Still, separation anxiety in a 3-year-old is well within the spectrum of normal developmental behavior, and eventually I was able to stay at school for 3 mornings a week by myself. And while I clearly exhibited signs of an inhibited temperament, shy, introverted, withdrawing from unfamiliar situations, and in a lab I probably would have displayed a hair-trigger startle reflex and high levels of cortisol in my blood, none of this was necessarily evidence of emerging psychopathology. Today, it's not hard to see that my early behavioral inhibition was a harbinger of my adult neurosis. But that's only in retrospect, seeing my anxiety as an unfolding narrative. At age 6, when I was in first grade, 2 new problems set in. The first was an intensified resurgence of my separation anxiety, about which more in a moment. The second was the onset of emetophobia, or the fear of vomiting, my original, most acute, and most persistent specific phobia. The first presenting symptom for some 85% of adults with anxiety disorders, according to data collected by Harvard Medical School researchers, is a specific phobia developed as a child. The same data, based on interviews with 250,000 people around the world, has also revealed that early experiences with anxiety tend to compound and metastasize. A child who develops a specific phobia, say, a fear of dogs, at age 6, is nearly 5 times more likely than a child without a fear of dogs to develop social phobia in her teenage years. That same child is then 2.2 times more likely than a child without an early dog phobia to develop major depression as an adult. Fear disorders, says Ron Kessler, the head of the Harvard study, have a very strong pattern of comorbidity over time, with the onset of the first disorder strongly predicting the onset of a second, which strongly predicts the onset of a third, and so on. Comorbidity is the medical term for the simultaneous presence of two chronic diseases or conditions in a patient. Anxiety and depression are often comorbid, with the presence of one predicting the presence of the other. Fear of dogs at age 5 or 10 is important not because fear of dogs impairs the quality of your life, Kessler says. Fear of dogs is important because it makes you 4 times more likely to end up a 25-year-old, depressed, high school dropout single mother who is drug dependent. The strong predictive association between a childhood fear of dogs and adult dysfunction might mean that a dog phobia somehow causes later social phobia, depression, or drug addiction. Or it might mean that a childhood fear of dogs and adult depression tend to be produced by the same kinds of environmental circumstances. An impoverished inner-city childhood, say, where dangerous pit bulls are a real threat and where early trauma or deprivation can lay the neural groundwork for later depression. Or it might mean that a fear of dogs and adult depression or drug addiction are different behavioral markers of a shared genetic underpinning. The same genetic coding that predisposes you to fear dogs might also predispose you to depression. Or, finally, maybe a childhood fear of dogs is actually the very same thing as adult panic disorder or depression. That is, it might be that childhood phobia and adult depression are the same disease, unfolding over the life cycle through different developmental stages, each stage expressing different symptoms. As I've noted, specific phobias tend to appear early in life. Half of all people who will ever have a phobia in their lives first develop it between the ages of 6 and 16. So perhaps a dog phobia is simply the first symptom of a broader disorder, the way a sore throat can augur the onset of a cold. While the nature of the link between childhood phobia and adult psychopathology is not clear, the fact of it is, which is why Kessler insists that early diagnosis and treatment is so important. If it turns out that dog phobia does somehow cause adult psychopathology, then the successful early treatment of phobic children could reduce later incidence of depression by 30 to 50%. Even if it's only by 15%, that's significant. The numbers from Kessler's study would seem to lend a statistical fadedness to the progression of my anxiety, from specific phobia at age 6 to social phobia starting around age 11 to panic disorder in my late teens to agoraphobia and depression in young adulthood. I have been, in my pathogenesis, the development of my pathology, a textbook case. Missing someone who is loved and longed for is the key to an understanding of anxiety. Sigmund Freud, Inhibitions, Symptoms, and Anxiety, 1926. When I was 6 years old, my mother started attending law school at night. My father says this was at his instigation because he'd seen how my mother's mother had become depressed and alcoholic as a stay-at-home suburban housewife without professional aspirations. My mother, for her part, says that it was over my father's objections that she started studying law. She adds, furthermore, that her mother was neither depressed nor an alcoholic. My mother is presumably the better authority here, but for what it's worth, my grandmother, whom I loved dearly, often did smell appealingly of gin. The powerful recrudescence of my separation anxiety coincided with the beginning of my mother's first year in law school. Each day during first grade, I would be driven home from school in a carpool to be greeted by one of a series of neighborhood babysitters. The babysitters were all very nice. Nevertheless, nearly every evening ended the same way, with me pacing around my bedroom, waiting desperately for my father to come home from work. Because nearly every night, for about 4 years, and then intermittently for about 10 more years after that, I was convinced that my parents were not coming home, that they had died or abandoned me, and that I had been orphaned, a prospect that was unbearably terrifying to me. Even though every night provided yet another piece of evidence that my parents always did come home, that never provided reassurance. This time, I was always convinced, they're really not coming back. So I would pace around my room and sit on the radiator, peering hopefully out the window, and listen desperately for the rumble of my father's Volkswagen. He was supposed to be home by no later than 6:30. So as the clock clicked past 6:10 and 6:15, I would begin suffering my nightly paroxysms of anxiety and despair. Sitting on the radiator, nose pressed up against the window, I'd try to will him home, mentally picturing his return, the Volkswagen turning off Common Street and onto Clark Street, heading up the hill and left onto Clover, then right onto our street, Blake, and then I'd look down the street and listen for the rumble of the car. And? Nothing. I'd stare at my bedroom clock, my agitation increasing as the seconds ticked by. Imagine you have just been told that a loved one has died in a car crash. Every night produced the same 15 to 30 minutes of effectively believing I had been told just that. A half hour of exquisite agony, during which I was absolutely, resolutely convinced that my parents had died or that they had abandoned me, even as the babysitter blandly played board games with my sister downstairs. And then, finally, usually by 6:30 and almost always by 7, the Volkswagen would come motoring down the street and turn into the driveway, and a burst of relief-born euphoria would cascade through me. He's home. He's alive. I haven't been abandoned. And then the next night I would go through this all over again. Weekends, when my parents went out together, were even worse. My fears of abandonment were not rational. Most of the time I was convinced my parents had died in a car crash. Other times, I was sure they had simply decided to leave, either because they didn't love me anymore, or because they weren't really my parents after all. Sometimes I thought they were aliens, sometimes I thought they were robots. At times I was convinced that my sister was an adult midget who had been trained to play the part of a 5-year-old girl, while her colleagues, my parents, performed whatever experiments they were carrying out before abandoning me. My mother, more attuned to my anxiety than my father was, clued into how I would start my worrying well in advance of when they had promised to be home. So when they were leaving, and I would ask ritually, "What's the latest you'll be back?" my mother would announce a time 15 or 20 minutes later than when she actually estimated they would return. But I cottoned on to this gambit soon enough, so I would factor in that extra time and begin my worried pacing 45 minutes or an hour before the stated latest time. And my mother, picking up on this, moved her stated return time still later, but I would pick up on that, and we were often running on a kind of arms race of stated and assumed return times that eventually rendered anything she said meaningless to me, so my anxiety would rise from the moment they left. This weekend worrying went on, I hate to say, for a long time. As a young teenager, I sometimes called, or forced my sister to call, parties my parents were at to make sure they were still alive. On several occasions, I woke neighbors, and once the minister of the Episcopal Church around the block, by banging on their doors late in the evening to tell them that my parents weren't home and that I thought they might be dead and to please call the police. When I was 6, this was embarrassing to my parents. When I was 13, it was mortifying. By the time I was 12, even being alone in my room at night, down the hall from my parents, less than 15 feet away, had become an ordeal. "Do you promise everything will be okay?" I would ask my mother when she tucked me in at night. As my emetophobia got worse, I worried I would wake up vomiting. This made me anxious and queasy at bedtime. Feeling that way one night, I told my mother, "I'm not feeling well. Can you please be especially on the alert tonight?" She said she would be. But then a few nights later, I must have been feeling even more nervous than usual, because I said, Can you please be especially, especially, especially on the alert tonight? I remember the exact wording because I began asking that question every night. Eventually, this escalated into a ritual, one with a precise and weird sequence to it that persisted until I went to college. Do you promise everything will be okay? I promise. And will you be especially, 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 especially 357 1/4 times on the alert? Yes. Like a psalm, with the stress always on the 5th, especially, every night for years. My separation anxiety affected nearly every aspect of my life. I was a reasonably coordinated athlete as a pre-adolescent, but here's how my first baseball practice ended. With me, age 6, crying in the dugout alongside a kindly but puzzled coach. I never went back. Here's how my first beginner's swimming lesson ended. With me, age 7, fearfully, tearfully refusing to get in the pool with the other children. Here's how my first soccer practice ended. With me, age 8, crying on the sideline with the babysitter who'd brought me, resisting entreaties to join the other boys doing drills. Here's how I spent my first morning at day camp when I was 5, sobbing by my cubby, crying that I missed my mommy and wanted to go home. Here's how I spent the first 2 hours at my first, and only, overnight at camp when I was 7, sobbing in the corner with a passel of befuddled counselors trying, serially and without success, to console me. Here's how I spent the drive to college with my parents, sobbing in the back seat, consumed by anxiety and anticipatory homesickness, worried that my parents would not love me after I went away to college, away, in this case, being a mere 3 miles from my parents' house. Why could I never feel assured of my parents' love or protection? Why were ordinary childhood activities so difficult? What existential reassurance was I seeking in my nightly call and response with my mother? The first anxiety is the loss of the object in the form of maternal care. After infancy, and throughout the rest of life, loss of love becomes a new and far more abiding danger and occasion for anxiety. Sigmund Freud, The Problem of Anxiety, 1926. In 1905, Sigmund Freud wrote, "Anxiety in children is nothing other than an expression of the fact that they are feeling the loss of the person they love." And so-called separation anxiety has remained a focus of researchers and clinicians ever since. Decades of studies by psychologists, primatologists, anthropologists, endocrinologists, ethologists, and others have revealed again and again in myriad ways the paramount significance of the early mother-child bond in determining the lifelong well-being of the child. The nature of that mother-child relationship starts getting established at the moment the infant enters the world with the trauma of birth, as the early Freudian psychoanalyst Otto Rank put it, if not earlier than that. Experiences in the womb and during infancy can have profound effects on a child's sense of well-being that last for decades, and that can even, according to recent research, persist into subsequent generations of offspring. Yet for all his astuteness about the role of early childhood experiences in predicting lifelong emotional health, Freud was for most of his career strangely blind to the ways early parent-child relationships affect the human psyche. This seems to have been especially true in the case of his own psyche. For many years, Freud endured a debilitating phobia of train travel. The train phobia first presented itself, according to Freud's own account, in 1859, when he was 3 years old. His father's wool business had collapsed, prompting the Freuds to relocate from Freiburg, a small Austro-Hungarian town, now Pribor in the Czech Republic, to Vienna. When the family arrived at the train station in Freiburg, young Sigmund was filled with dread The gas jet lights that illuminated the station made him think of souls burning in hell. He was terrified that the train would depart without him, taking his parents and leaving him behind. For years thereafter, train travel caused him anxiety attacks. His life was circumscribed by his travel phobia. For a long time, he professed a desire to visit Rome, but was deterred from going by what he came to call his Rome neurosis. When compelled to travel anywhere by train with his family, he would book himself into a separate compartment from his wife and children because he was ashamed to have them witness his fits of anxiety. He compulsively insisted on getting to railway stations hours in advance of departure because he forever retained the intense fear of being left behind that he first experienced as a 3-year-old. A modern therapist might naturally attribute Freud's travel phobia to his childhood fears of abandonment. Freud himself did not. Rather, as he wrote to his friend Wilhelm Fliess in 1897, he believed that what prompted his anxiety was seeing his mother naked in their train compartment while en route from Freiburg to Vienna. Witnessing this at a time when his libido toward Matrem had awakened must have aroused him sexually, Freud surmised. And even as a 3-year-old, he would have known the taboo nature of such incestuous desire and would therefore have repressed it. This act of repression, he theorized, generated anxiety that he neurotically transmuted into a phobia of trains. "You yourself have seen my travel anxiety at its height," he reminds Fliess. Tellingly, Freud couldn't actually recall seeing his mother nude on the train. He just supposed that he must have, and that he'd then pushed the image down into his unconscious. From this strained supposition, he generalized that all train phobia derives from repressed sexual desire, and that those who are subject to attacks of anxiety on the journey are actually protecting themselves against a repetition of the painful experience by a dread of railway travel. On the basis of this quite likely imagined experience, Freud over the years elaborated his Oedipus complex and concluded that this was a universal event in early childhood. He would eventually make the Oedipus complex the centerpiece of his psychoanalytic theory of neurosis. According to Freud's theory of the Oedipus complex, a boy's greatest anxiety is that his father will castrate him as punishment for sexually desiring his mother. And a girl's greatest anxiety is generated by her envy of the penis she lacks. This was largely derived from Freud's own recollection of, as he wrote Fliess, being in love with my mother and jealous of my father. Was my own separation anxiety as a young boy, and are my abiding anxiety and dependency issues as an adult, attributable to my repressed sexual feelings for my mother? It certainly never felt that way to me. Of course, Freud would say that it wouldn't have felt that way. His whole point was that such feelings are repressed into the unconscious and transmuted into anxiety about other things, trains or heights or snakes or whatever. And in support of Freud, I confess there is this. The name of my first crush in 5th grade was Anne. The name of my first post-college girlfriend, whom I dated for 3 years, was Anne. The girl I dated immediately after Anne, for nearly 2 years, was named Anna. The girl I left Anna for was named Anne, and my wife's name is Susanna. My mother's name? Anne, of course. I used to joke that dating all those Anns, and Annas reduced the likelihood I would call any of them by the wrong name, because even the wrong name would sound like the right one. But Freud would say that what I was really in danger of calling them, that what I was seeking with all those Anns, and Annas, was Mom. Lending still further Oedipal determinism to my romantic relations is the fact that my paternal grandmother was also named Anne, meaning that my father also married a woman with the same name as his mother. But there is, of course, a less sexual explanation for how Freud's early childhood experiences might have produced his lifelong anxiety and train phobia. The first years of Freud's life were colored by loss and by the wavering attention of his mother, Amalia. Shortly after he was born, in 1856, his mother got pregnant again, giving birth to another son, Julius. Less than a year later, Julius died, felled by an intestinal infection. At the time, the Freud family lived in a one-room apartment, so it's likely that Sigmund, as a toddler, witnessed at close hand his brother's death and his parents' reaction to it. Some of Freud's biographers have suggested that Julius's death sent Amalia into a depression that would have made her remote and unavailable to Sigmund. Depression in mothers of children this age can be highly predictive of anxiety and depression in those children later in life. With his mother emotionally unavailable, Freud naturally turned to an alternative maternal figure, the nursemaid, a Czech Catholic woman who cared for him in the early years of his life. But while Sigmund was still a small child, the nursemaid was caught stealing and sent to jail. He never saw her again. The logical conclusion here would seem to be that Freud's train phobia was a response to the fear of abandonment produced by this string of childhood losses, the death of his brother, the emotional unavailability of his mother, and the sudden disappearance of his primary caretaker. But Freud remained fixated on proving the rightness of his sexual explanations of anxiety and his Oedipus complex. He would exile from the fold anyone, including Alfred Adler, Carl Jung, and Otto Rank, who dared question their centrality. All anxiety goes back to the anxiety at birth. Otto Rank, The Trauma of Birth, 1924. Later in his career, as Freud moved from his repressed libido theory of anxiety to his intrapsychic conflict theory, he began to take more account of the way in which parent-child relations, object relations, in the psychoanalytic argot, related to anxiety. The final shifts in Freud's theory of anxiety were motivated by his disavowal of a book written by one of his most devoted acolytes. Otto Rank, the secretary of Freud's Vienna Psychoanalytical Society, had intended The Trauma of Birth, published in 1924, as a tribute to his mentor. The book is dedicated to Freud, the explorer of the unconscious, creator of psychoanalysis. Rank's basic argument, elaborated at great length, was that birth, both the physical act of passing through the uterine canal and the psychological fact of separation from the mother, is so traumatic that the experience becomes the template for all future experiences of anxiety. In making this claim, Rank was building on what Freud himself had already argued. The act of birth is the first experience of anxiety and thus the source and prototype of the effect of anxiety, Freud had written in a footnote to the second edition of The Interpretation of Dreams in 1908, and he repeated this notion in a speech he gave to the Vienna Psychoanalytical Society the following year. James Strachey, a British psychoanalyst and translator of Freud's works, speculated that Freud's linking of childbirth and anxiety dated to the early 1880s, when, while working as a physician, he heard secondhand about a midwife who had declared that there is a lifelong connection between birth and being frightened. But The Trauma of Birth was a work of such extravagant interpretive brio that Freud, though no stranger to extravagant interpretive leaps himself, found it alienating and bewildering. And he devoted a full chapter of The Problem of Anxiety to renouncing it. Rank believed the birth trauma explained everything, from territorial conquests like Alexander the Great's, motivated by an attempt to gain sole possession of the mother from the father, to revolutions like the French, an attempt to overthrow masculine dominance and return to the mother, to phobia of animals, a rationalization of the wish through the desire to be eaten, to get back again into the mother's womb, to the apostles' dedication to Jesus Christ. They could see in him one who had overcome the birth trauma. Some of Freud's later disciples would denounce Ronk, not without reason, as insane. Ronk's arguments forced Freud to wrestle once more with the ways in which early life experiences are relevant to anxiety. This led him to revise his own theory of it. In the final chapter of The Problem of Anxiety, Freud gives brief attention to what he called the biological factor, by which he meant the protracted helplessness and dependence of the young of the human species. Freud writes that the human infant is sent into the world more unfinished than the young of other species, meaning that humans emerge much more highly dependent on their mothers for their survival than do other animals. Most animals emerge from the uterus or the egg dependent to some extent on parental care for their survival, but the majority of them are relatively less dependent than humans are at birth. The infant seems to be born with an instinctive sense that the mother can provide sustenance and succor, and learns very quickly that whereas the mother's presence equals safety and comfort, her absence equals danger and discomfort. Observing this, Freud concluded that the earliest human anxiety, and thus to some degree the source of all subsequent ones, is a reaction to the loss of the object being the mother. This biological factor of helplessness thus brings into being the need to be loved, which the human being is destined never to renounce, Freud writes. The first anxiety is about the loss of a mother's care. Throughout the balance of life, loss of love becomes a new and far more abiding danger and occasion for anxiety. In the final pages of The Problem of Anxiety, Freud briefly develops the idea that phobic anxiety in adults is the residue of human evolutionary adaptations. Phobias of such things as thunderstorms, animals, strangers, being alone, and being in the dark represent the atrophied remnants of innate preparedness against real dangers that existed in the state of nature. For early man and woman, being alone, or in the dark, or bitten by a snake or a lion, and, of course, the separation of an infant from his mother, were legitimate mortal threats. In all of this, Freud was anticipating the work of the biologists and neuroscientists who would study phobias in the decades ahead. Freud did retain for psychoanalysis some interpretive elan by positing that childhood phobias become overly severe or persistent to adulthood only when they become the outer fears of rats or heights or darkness or thunder or open spaces or mayonnaise, a noted phobia in the literature, onto which inner psychic conflicts get projected. Phobias, in this view, are the outward symbolic representations of the threats that the id, with its wanton impulses that must be repressed, and the superego, with its strict demands of conscience and morality, place on the ego. In other words, Freud was, in his 70s, in an addendum to one of his final works, finally moving closer to what would become the modern scientific understanding of anxiety. But by then, it was too late. Freud's followers were off to the races with Oedipus conflicts and penis envy and castration anxiety and inferiority complexes, Adler, and the collective unconscious, Jung, and death instincts, Melanie Klein, and oral and anal fixations, Carl Abraham, and so-called fantasies about the good breast and the bad breast, Klein again. For a generation, as the field grew in the years leading up to and following the Second World War, the prevailing psychoanalytic view was that anxiety was caused by dammed-up sexual drives. While parents are held to play a major role in causing a child to develop a heightened susceptibility to fear, their behavior is seen not in terms of moral condemnation, but as having been determined by the experiences they themselves had as children. John Bowlby, Separation, Anxiety and Anger, 1973. The person most responsible for unlocking the mysteries of separation anxiety and for installing the concept near the center of modern psychiatry was the British psychoanalyst John Bowlby, who did as much as anyone to rescue psychoanalysis from its more torturous theoretical overreaching. Trained in the 1930s by Freud's protege Melanie Klein, Bowlby would go on to develop what has become known as attachment theory, the idea that an individual's anxiety level derives largely from the nature of the relationship with early attachment figures, most commonly the mother. Bowlby was born in 1907 to an aristocratic surgeon who ministered to the King of England, and he would later claim that his was a very stable background. But it's not hard to see that Bowlby's clinical and research interests, like Freud's, were informed by his own childhood experiences. Bowlby's mother, according to the psychologist Robert Caron, was a sharp, hard, self-centered woman who never praised the children and seemed oblivious to their emotional lives. Bowlby's father, generally absent, was something of an inflated bully. The Bowlby children ate completely apart from their parents until they were 12 years old, at which age they would be permitted to join their parents only for dessert. By the time Bowlby turned 12, he'd already been away from home at boarding school for 4 years. Publicly, he would always say his parents had sent him away because they wanted to protect him from the bombs they feared German zeppelins would drop on London during the First World War. In private, however, he confessed that he'd hated boarding school and that he wouldn't send a dog away so young. Robert Caron observes that almost everything Bowlby wrote about the needs of young children throughout his long career could be seen as an indictment of the type of upbringing to which he'd been subjected. Psychoanalysts before Bowlby were generally uninterested in the day-to-day relationship between parents and children. What interest they did have was focused on breastfeeding, toilet training, and especially instances in which a child witnessed his parents having sexual intercourse. Anyone who placed undue emphasis on a child's real experience, as opposed to on his internal fantasies, was regarded as pitifully naive, Bowlby would later recall. Once, while still a medical student, he watched with dismay as a series of case studies presented at the British Psychoanalytic Society traced patients' emotional disorders to childhood fantasies. Unable to bear it any longer, he blurted, "But there is such a thing as a bad mother." This sort of thing did not endear him to the psychoanalytic establishment. In 1938, while still in good standing with the mandarins of psychoanalysis, he was assigned as a supervisor, a doyen of the Freudian establishment, Melanie Klein. Born in Vienna and trained as a nursery school teacher, Klein would go on, after the end of an unhappy marriage, to be psychoanalyzed by two of Freud's closest disciples, Sándor Ferenczi and Carl Abraham, and then herself to become one of Freud's most important followers and interpreters. In 1926, Klein, 44 years old, moved to London, where she was exalted by Ernest Jones, the head of the British Psychoanalytic Society and the most ardent protector of Freud's legacy. Klein's arrival in London, and in particular her disagreements with Freud's daughter Anna Freud over the analysis and treatment of children, precipitated a rift in the society between the Kleinians and the Anna Freudians that would last through World War II. Bowlby would soon come to find himself at odds with many of Klein's views, such as that babies were seething miasmas of hatred, libido, envy, sadism, death instincts, and rage against the restraining superego, and that neuroses arose because of conflicts between the good breast and the evil breast. Klein herself was by most accounts an unpleasant person. Bowlby would later describe her as a frightfully vain old woman who manipulated people. But what most appalled him was Klein's disregard for the actual relationship between mother and child. The first case he treated under Klein's supervision was an anxious, hyperactive young boy. Bowlby noticed right away that the boy's mother was an extremely anxious, distressed woman who was wringing her hands in a very tense, unhappy state. To him, it seemed obvious that the mother's emotional problems were contributing to the boy's, and that a sensible course of treatment would include counseling for the mother. But Klein forbade Bowlby to talk to the woman. When the mother was eventually admitted to a mental hospital after a nervous breakdown, Klein's response was exasperation at having to find a new patient, since there was no longer anyone who could bring the boy to his appointments. The fact that this poor woman had had a breakdown was of no clinical interest to Klein whatever, Bowlby would say later. This horrified me, to be quite frank. And from that point onwards, my mission in life was to demonstrate that real-life experiences have a very important effect on development. In 1950, the chief of the mental health section of the World Health Organization, Ronald Hargreaves, commissioned from Bowlby a report on the psychological problems of the thousands of European children rendered homeless by the disruptions of World War II. Bowlby's report, Maternal Care and Mental Health, urged governments to recognize that a mother's affection was as important for mental health as are vitamins and proteins for physical health. Strange as it may seem now, in 1950 there wasn't much recognition of the effects of parenting on psychological development, especially within psychiatry, where treatment still often focused on the processing of inner fantasies. In his initial work on hysteria in the early 1890s, Freud had argued that adult neuroses were the product of actual early childhood traumas, mostly of a sexual nature. But by 1897, he had revised his view to support his emerging notion of the Oedipus complex, arguing now that adult neuroses were the result of repressed childhood fantasies about having sex